The Leadership Platform is brought to you by Sibanye Gold, a proudly South African mining company.
I am the future of South Africa. On my shoulders, I carry the hopes and dreams of generations to come. I'm eager to learn, but even more eager to use my knowledge for good. I know that it's not where I come from, but where I'm going to that really matters.
At Sibanye Gold, we believe our youth is worth its weight in gold, which is why we are so committed to developing, nurturing, and grooming our young people into future leaders. Sibanye Gold, we are one.
Leadership Platform Live, I'm Adrian Groenewald. With me, Louis Groenewald. Just the two of us today. And this is your weekly leadership masterclass. Free, inspirational, empowering leadership conversation every week. All you have to do every week at 12 to 1, put it in your diary and listen. And we will share with you and bring onto the platform top leaders. We are exporting leadership to the world. And this is your masterclass. You can visit leadershipplatform.com, two P's in the middle, for all things leadership, articles, and you can give us comments. Who do you think we should interview? Any thoughts and feelings that you have? Our very special guest is former President Kgalema Motlanthe, who joins us in the studio, and he will be the focus of our attention today. President, welcome.
Good morning, Adrian, and good morning to your listeners, as well as old Louis here.
Yes, that's right. So I'm sitting here. I feel very young today. I've got two wise men in front of me. One is my father, and the other one is a former president of our country. So I'm very intimidated, but I'm excited. And I remember our previous engagement, President. We sat at the home in Pretoria. You were deputy president. And I really have fond memories of it. For about an hour and a half, we just talked about leadership, the country. And I was able to write about that, and that stuck with me. You walked me to the door afterwards. It didn't feel like a deputy president. It felt like, I don't know, something else. And I really enjoyed that engagement, which is why I wanted you on the show to talk about leadership and to talk about your life. Last week, before we move on, the podcast last week was about leading with empathy. So do download that. Great guests. Rich Simmons ran it for us. And you're welcome to go download that podcast. The first part of the show, we're going to speak to the president about our South African leadership heritage. We all know where we come from. We all know the miracle that happened. And before I ask you to define what you think is our leadership heritage, do you feel more free now? When I sat with you last time, I got the feeling when you're deputy president, your life is never your own. You know, your program is worked out in detail. Mm-hmm. There's no freedom at all. Do you have a little bit more? Can you actually read? Do you have a little bit more time to yourself these days? Or is that a fallacy? That never comes.
Well, that's a fallacy, really. It never happens that way because, yeah. You know, as someone who was in public office, I got trained to accept that I needed to be managed. And once you submit to that form of training, it stays with you for the rest of your life. Yeah. Otherwise, there would be too many accidents. I mean, if I were to manage my own diary, I think I will double book because I'll agree to all kinds of commitments, you know.
Yeah. All right.
So I'm still managed. Yeah.
You're still managed?
Yeah.
But not as strenuous, surely?
No.
A little bit more.
In a sense, if you like, I'm marching to a different drum beat now.
Yeah, you've marched to some interesting drum beats. All right, South Africa, if there's one thing we believe that should be exported, it's our leadership heritage in some way. Partially why I wrote that book. The title says Universal Lessons from South Africa, because we were hoping we can share it with the world. We really can share. How would you summarize, define our leadership heritage as a nation?
Well, you know, we are products of our own environment, and our environment is a microcosm of the world, because people have always come from all parts of the world to South Africa. When we speak to the tapestry of, you know, the South African nation, where we're literally talking about experiences of people who came from all parts of the world, and that has enriched you know, our experiences of who we are, because those who came before us laid down solid foundations for understanding you know, the issues of the world as a whole, and so that is why many in across the world looked up to South Africa to solve the problem, the intractable, stubborn problem of racism and racial discrimination. And many, in their own ways, in their own humble ways, in universities across the world, participated in the demonstrations against apartheid and so on, and so they literally invested emotionally and thought-wise and so on in South Africa succeeding to resolve this problem of racial discrimination. And even though right up to the end it looked as though there was going to be a conflagration in this country. And the fact that a peaceful solution was ultimately found to resolve the problems by sitting around the table inspired many, many people. In other words, it lived up to expectations of those who had invested you know, emotionally in South Africa finding a resolution to that problem. Whether we are now living up to their expectations is a horse of a different color.
So politically we did something right there. Now it's a different kettle of fish, you know. Could I describe part of our leadership heritage like this? It's about creating impossible movement against impossible resistance towards becoming the impossible. And as everyone quotes former President Mandela, it always seems impossible until it's done. So we somehow we brought different groupings together, very diverse aspirations, and we did the impossible. And we know we still have our problems, but that was amazing.
Yes, yes. That's why it was described as a miracle. Because in a sense, the way we were poised to decimate each other, you know, the worst was to be expected. And yet, there was also, in a sense, an expectation that we would outdo ourselves in finding a solution. And in that regard, I think the leadership of people like Nelson Mandela, F.W. de Klerk, and didn't disappoint you. They really rose to the occasion.
It's easy to forget that, isn't it? To not amalgamate that heritage into 2015, to bring it closer and to appreciate it and live up to it. I also say in the book, we belong to a great nation, chosen above all others to fulfill our peculiar destiny of demonstrating, beyond Nelson Mandela, this leadership that the world is craving. We understand contention and discord on a deep level because we have tasted it. We should therefore understand and strive for its opposite on a deep level, which is true unity, and then live it. So we experienced movement from sure disaster to perceived impossible of unity and growth, performance, improvement, and so on and so forth. I mean, we should understand what other... I know Rolf Meyer, we had him in the studio. He travels the world, and people often tap into his intellectual property because he was in the heart of that. But are we realizing that we're a great nation, or do you think we suffer from an inferiority complex? The Americans can teach us more than we can teach them, as an example.
Well, the importance of history really lies in the fact that it gives you context. But history is inherited. The main challenge is how to create a better tomorrow. That's where the challenge lies. And of course, the two, in a sense, influence each other. The shadow of the past is cast over, the new environment, and yet the new environment is not supposed to be imprisoned by the shadow of the past.
Yeah.
So, in a word, one can say that the how to characterize, the current conjuncture is by ensuring that we repeat the lessons learned, because there are new entrants and young people who didn't experience the deep divide we come from, on the one hand, who are also important, players in today's South Africa, and tomorrow belongs to them.
Yeah.
And so if this tomorrow, one always thinks of distance.
Yeah.
Not in its spatial sense, but in its temporal sense. That when the living work out their future.
Yeah.
Yeah. When they map out a future, that in itself is a determination of distance. That's how far they prepared to travel. That's how far they prepared to go. And so, unless that is properly communicated to the younger generation, they may change course. They may be completely unaware of this distance that needs to be traveled.
Yeah.
And that's why it is important to continue in national discourse, to continue highlighting the lessons learned. Because, as I said, the past we inherit, the future we need to create.
And that gives them context. It gives them perspective. It gives them the bigger picture.
That's right.
And that's why leaders need to communicate so well and take the time to communicate so well. I mean, that's very valid what you're saying when we think of Youth Month coming up in June as well. All right, big question. What is the current state of our leadership in the country? We've had 20 years, almost 21 years. We're now matured as a young single adult in terms of our democracy. How, in a nutshell, I know there's good and bad, but are we living up to this leadership heritage? What is our current state?
Well, the important, and I think most inspiring element of, our South Africanness is that we are, in a sense, a nation of activists. South Africans will not roll over and die when there's an injustice being, meted out to them.
Yeah.
They will rise against any form of injustice.
They'll be negative and in the dumps, but somehow we lift ourselves.
Yes, and that's the saving grace, because when you think of it more deeply, progress in life is a working out of opposites.
Yes.
Once you get to a point where there is a such unanimity that it translates into monopoly, even in the realm of ideas, it is bound to lead to stagnation. And that is why it's important to create an environment in which people, organizations, parties, business can feel confident enough to express their honest views on any matter. That's what makes for a vibrant society.
We are a nation of opposites, aren't we? We have all that you're saying. The question is whether we have confidence in that process, because we get depressed. We're a manic society almost,
I think, let me tell you what I think is missing.
Yeah.
What is missing is the identification of what is our national cause.
Okay, that's not the what's the National Development Plan?
The National Development Plan is a plan.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a plan. And a plan works once it inspires efforts of ordinary citizens, wherever they are.
Yeah. Otherwise, it's dead.
Otherwise, it's not worth the paper it's written on.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, the point I'm making is, we have to all, you know, engage in a process that would define our national cause. What is it that we are pursuing?
Yeah.
Whether we are in a rugby team, or in a soccer team, or in business, or in teaching profession, or in any facet of life that we are in, there should be clarity that our efforts in those areas where we are located are aimed at advancing the national cause, national interest. That does not mean, you know, equalizing everything and so on, but it means knowing that you cannot lower the bar, because you would be, if you lower the bar, if you put in half an effort where a full effort is required, you would, in a sense, arresting the advancement of that cause. That's what is lacking.
And I think the National Development Plan, the spirit of it, but it dies down when it's not communicated with that perspective, that context, with the heart, the emotion that you mentioned. Yeah. I know the vision is like a poem, and you know there's wonderful things in there. So I think the intention of it is, of course, to do that. Yeah. But so our current state of leadership, you think, lacks that perspective and that power?
It lacks that because, look, if you take, I mean, I'm from government. If you take government, there's need to appreciate the importance of having a stable, capable state, and understanding the relationship between such a state and government, because government becomes the face of the state for a term. Governments come and go, but the state has to remain in place, stable, capable. That's where delivery comes from. If you don't have a working state, one that is capable, that one that is run efficiently and so on, then you know, you will experience lack of, you know, services, or you'll end up receiving poor services. So it's important, and the National Development Plan refers to the importance of a capable state, having a capable state. But I think the notion of a state as distinct from government is not well understood and well appreciated. That's why you have a high turnover even of senior managers in the state, without the appreciation that, in fact, that leads to destabilization or instability in the state. And if you don't have a stable state, there's not much you can do. So I'm linking this to the understanding of what our national cause is, and that such a national cause wants, where, you know, defined and embraced, should be pursued with determination by all and sundry.
And that's not difficult in our microcosm of the world. You know, it really is a fascinating country with so many challenges. And just now, a little bit later on, I'm going to explore exactly what it's like running a country like this, and I think you'll be able to give us perspective. Then just last on this, what is our biggest leadership challenge then, over and above what you just said, in South Africa? What do you think is the biggest obstacle or barriers to us taking our heritage forward, over and above this course that needs to be defined emotionally and physically, and communicated better, and unity around it? What's holding our nation back practically?
You know, many people are always you know, amazed by the fact that Nelson Mandela emerged from prison after 27 years of incarceration, without any rancor or bitterness and so on. But what is really remarkable is the fact that he used that time in prison to reflect on the responsibilities of statehood. And so he walked out of prison already very clear about the responsibilities of, you know, heads of state and what role he needed to play in the process. That is why it came almost as second nature to him.
Natural, yeah.
To, you know, contribute, always be alive to the fact that we needed to unite our people. South Africans needed unity. And with equal force, South Africa needed democracy to be, you know, practiced and consolidated. South Africa needed non-racialism to, because the unity and of our people being so diverse, and that's why the Constitution in its preamble refers to unity in diversity.
Yeah.
That, you know, whilst recognizing the fact that people have their own folk laws and practices to follow, however, that should happen within the framework of a united non-racial democratic society.
Is that what we miss? Just back to unity.
I'm using Nelson Mandela because I think he understood, because it's all about understanding. He understood, and that's why it was so easy for him. He said that if you're a leader, you must surround yourself with people who are even better talented than you are. But it takes a certain level of self-confidence for a leader to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You must be sure about yourself inside.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Inside. And not feel threatened by those who are better talented than you are. And Nelson Mandela understood that very well and exuded it in his deportment generally. And that is why he was such an inspiring leader. And he's left us that legacy as an example to emulate. And I think we should strive for it. That's why I was referring to the need for a national cause.
Yeah.
Because such leadership has to be exercised not only in political platforms, but in sport, in business, in education, in all phases of life, if we are to succeed.
He made it look so easy in some ways, you know, this ability to unite. And that's what we need again. We're doing a lot of things, but there seems to be a trust deficit between leaders and followers in general, globally. I'm not just talking South Africa. And we have that now. It takes incredible leadership and maturity. To be able to do that, to create that unity.
You know, when I watch some of the sessions in the National Assembly from time to time, I get a sense that, you know, at the slightest irritation, there's a temptation to dial back to pre-1994, as though 1994 didn't happen. And yet 1994 did happen. And the implications of that happening was that no one bears the burden of guilt, because it meant that we're breaking with the past.
Yeah.
And starting on a new footing. And that is why we need this national cause and the commitment to pursue it, the determination to pursue it.
A commitment, determination, focus.
Yeah.
Sure, it takes selfless determination from someone, from leadership to do that. Fascinating. We're speaking to former President Kgalema Motlanthe. He's in the studio with us, and we're talking about our leadership heritage. We're going to talk to him in more detail about some leadership experiences he's had. We're taking a quick break, and then we'll be back with him.
At Sibanye Gold, we believe leaders are made, not born. We also believe we can create a sustainable legacy by helping to develop tomorrow's leaders today, which is why we have partnered with the Leadership Platform to nurture leaders who are committed to growing our country's economy.
We are proud to say it's an initiative that's already showing glittering results. Sibanye Gold, we are one.
Herman Mashaba, top entrepreneur and founder of Black Like Me, says, this book captures our South African leadership heritage well. Gareth Cliff says, better, more effective leadership is the one thing every South African agrees we need. What makes a great leader? Read this book. Neil Fruneman, CEO Sibanye Gold, says, seamless leadership is a vital contribution to grooming a future generation of leaders that will guide our nation through turbulent passages that inevitably lie ahead. Ian Donald, Nestle South Africa CEO, says, as one of South Africa's foremost leadership experts, Adrian Groenewald clearly outlines the approach leaders across the globe should adopt. Whether you are a CEO, a manager, a teacher, politician, or parent, get yourself and your team a copy of Seamless Leadership, Universal Lessons from South Africa. This book and the principles it teaches is exactly what you and the world need now. Visit your nearest exclusive books or CNA store, or, of course, order from Amazon. President Kgalema Motlanthe in the studio. Was it destiny for you to rise to the top of a nation and lead it for a while, also as president and also deputy president? Or was it luck? Was it? How do you see it? Did you feel destiny?
I think it was an accident of history, because you know, several factors connived to create a certain set of circumstances that fostered on me the responsibility to lead the country at a very difficult time. To try and build a bridge so that there could be a seamless, transition from that dark hour into a more enlightened future.
So maybe destiny put you on the path of politics, of being part of the discourse in the country, but you didn't necessarily feel. One looks at Nelson Mandela and you feel it was absolute destiny. That one man had to rise to the top and somehow overcome impossible barriers, determine the attitude of us as a nation, or influence it so that we could do the miracles. In your case, you feel it was this conniving of a lot of factors. And that's the case in all of our lives, isn't it?
Yes.
It's not just destiny. There's so many elements.
No.
Impact of your upbringing. It seemed to be very, in a way, disciplined, Christian, values-driven. What is the basis of your value system?
Well, firstly, that I was named after my grandparents, and so I had the unique experience of being referred to as a father, as an uncle, by my aunts and my my parents, because I was named after their parents. Mm. And that instilled lots of respect, because I was respected by my elders, and therefore socialized to reciprocate, and that has stayed with me, that I must in all respects respect any fellow human being. It doesn't matter whether you are much younger than I am or much older, or that your station in life really doesn't matter to me. So that's what really determines my attitude towards fellow human beings, is that I should respect them.
Louis Groenewald sitting in the corner there. He's lived through a couple of years Your thoughts. So that's impacted. Our childhood always impacts us, doesn't it? And then maybe just before we move on, the wisdom that the former president shared with us about leadership heritage. You had any thoughts there?
President, Adi and I come from Afrikaner background, mm-hmm. and a lot of it, as you probably know, is pretty right-wing from the past. Mm-hmm. We've evolved, though, and we've been passionate about the vision you've spoken about today, and we respect it highly. Our major concern, President, we have on the leadership side is the price of democracy is freedom of speech, which is so vital. This station, the Central, portrays that. In our case, though, we are so passionate about uniting that common bond of good leadership, which is not just the Mandela tremendous tradition, but many people around him as well, including some pretty much strong people like Constant Viljoen and my brother, etc. But we're concerned at the opposition mentality or mindset there is. In principle, freedom of speech is sometimes interpreted as you can't oppose anything that comes from government. So you don't see the goodness, the quality, the leadership heritage that is spoken about today. Now, we are concerned at many talented people that are bound by shackles because of it. Your feelings on that?
Well, as I said, progress in life is a working out of opposites. And my experience as someone who was in government is that you need direct feedback from the people. And feedback comes in the form of, you know, some people will commend your efforts. Others will highlight shortcomings in your efforts. And others will, but they have suggestions. People who criticize also make suggestions as to, you know, what they think would have worked better and so on. So it's only, you know, a government that has its head in the sand which doesn't invite feedback, because criticism is underpinned by self-criticism. The consciousness to know between right and wrong is an attribute that separates human beings from the rest of the animal kingdom. And that is why a human being is capable of self-criticism. And if you are capable of that, then you will not regard criticism as an attack, because you exercise on an ongoing basis. When you make judgments, you know, value judgments, or you make choices, that's self-criticism. You are assessing and evaluating, you know, circumstances and making choices. And so when you are criticized, you have the ability to accept that as a reinforcement of your own ability to self-critique.
And to grow. Adrian, President, you give us an insight into your character when you said these things, and I think many people see you that way. Of course, I think some of the younger leaders in politics don't necessarily see it that way. They tend to feel offended very quickly. And what you're saying, this is the vision, this is the tradition that Arden spoke about of our leadership heritage. The hundreds of people we contact at present have a common theme, top leaders now, is that you need to engage. And what you're saying is, you're saying, yeah, you need to have direct feedback. Now, that means don't fear the engagement to leaders out there. And this is what you're saying is, because yes, it may be negative, but it is always something positive, and it always tends to reinforce or even change one's own views. Thank you for that.
Go behind it to the suggestions that may typically be there. Yeah. Matthew Sporza, by the way, sends his regards.
Thank you.
I connected with him. He said to me, you're a deep thinker. I guess that comes from your upbringing maybe as well. You examine everything properly before you open your mouth. A kind man, a clever leader. Were you always like this, supposing he's right and I'm believing him? Were you always a deep thinker as a child?
Well, No, this is something you learn. I mean, with time, being mentored, being guided, and you know, reading to learn from the experience of humanity. Yeah.
Mm. You were a great soccer player.
I used to play football.
You used to play yeah. football.
Not great football, just football.
yeah, otherwise. But you're still a fan. You watch, enjoy it.
I do. Yes.
Is that your main sport you love?
I watch various sporting codes. Yeah, but yeah, football, where time permitting, that's what I watch. Yeah.
Yeah. I want to describe you as a peacemaker, and I tweeted this weekend saying the world does not have enough peacemakers. Mm-hmm. And I'll share it at the end of the show as well as a summary, as an inspirational thought. Would that be fair? Do you in your nature have this desire for peacemaking?
Well, you know, peace and stability are a precondition for development, because when you have strive, so much time and effort gets expended in trying to normalize situations, and that's a distraction from the focus on the basic and fundamental issues that matter really to society. So, if differences arise, it's always helpful to understand that these are differences on specific matters, and that it doesn't necessarily mean you now differ on all other issues.
Or even the big picture, you probably agree on it.
Yes,
yeah.
you differ on a specific matter, and if you are able to isolate it and ring fence it that way, you can deal with those differences and still be able to work together on the other areas where there's a meeting point and a common approach. Yeah.
So if you have a peacemaking type style, okay, engaging style, then sometimes those leaders find contention difficult. So when there's not conflict is good, difference of opinion, but contention, argument, is that something you shy away from?
No. I think unless you know you create an environment in which people can air their most honest opinions, you will never get to know how they think. You'll never get to know how they approach matters. That's why it's important, particularly if you are in a leadership position, to draw from the collective brain of whatever committee you serve in. And you can only draw from it if all members have a right to speak their minds on any matter, because by the time you reach a conclusion, you draw from all of their takes on issues, and that's why one of the points I liked from your book is the appreciation of process, that matters must be processed.
Yeah.
Thoughts must be processed before you arrive at a determination.
Yeah.
If you don't do that, then you may be satisfied with too few reasons, or you may doubt forever, and be paralyzed by doubt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as a leader, you're either decisive or decisive, indecisive or decisive in process.
Yeah.
And all of them have their pros and cons, but the latter is what seamless leaders try and do. I'm not a journalist, but I am fascinated by the fact that if I have the information correctly, that there were two very pivotal moments in our politics where someone had to go to the former President Mbeki and say, we'd like you to resign. Mm-hmm. And someone had to go to President Zuma and ask the same thing,
mm-hmm.
not in that sequence. And in both cases, you were maybe due to position or due to the fact that you're a peacemaker and your background and the kind of man you are, great respect for you, you had to be there to go and share that bad news.
Yes.
If I can, what was that like? What did you learn from that? That can't be nice. That can't be pleasant to do that.
Well, you know, these were the two men were leaders of the ANC. And the ANC had, over the years, left us a solid body of value systems. And we all commit to be driven by those mores, you know, that were passed on to us by our predecessors. And our predecessors were made of people who were leaders in their own right, individually, but who were never of the view that for one to lead, you have to be in a leadership position. They led also from behind.
Without title, I
said. Without title.
Yeah.
And so the question of title has its place, but wasn't the be-all and end-all. And that is the basis upon which, you know, I was asked to go and speak to them.
Yeah.
As people who, you know, were assumed to appreciate these mores of the ANC.
That's their doctrinal background. That's the more. So your expectation is there will be a certain response. So I don't want to leave today without this man in front of me explaining to us honestly what it's like running a country. Because we judge our presidents like we know, but we are clueless. What is it practically like to run a country? When you were president for, was it 9 months? So you obviously saw it very much in the close inner circle, but then you sat in that hot seat particularly. Practically, what's it like?
Well, firstly, the buck stops with you when you are head of state, but you are called head of state because you are at the head of a state.
Yeah.
And earlier on, I referred to the importance of the state being stable. And that means you have your senior managers in place. You know, we call them directors general. In other countries, like in the UK, they are called permanent secretaries because they are not to be changed even when the government changes, even when the different parties come and go as government. But these are permanent secretaries.
That's a British system as well. Americans tend to change them very quickly at the top.
Well, the Americans change the advisors, not the state.
The state
remains in place because the state has to be stable. And there has to be institutional memory. And so these are senior people who must who will have the understandings of the workings of the state. And that's why that institutional memory is so critical.
Yeah.
I'll give you an example. In our current government, there are two most stable departments. That's Treasury, because of its functions. And the second one is Science and Technology.
Okay.
Yeah, Science and Technology is very stable because the Director General has been in that office for a long time and he's recruited fellow scientists who populate the department, who are stable. And you need that stability for people to give their all and be, you know, creative and innovative. They need that stability. If you create a sense that with the change of the political heads, the political leadership, there will be changes in the bureaucracy.
Danger, yeah.
Then you create a sense of uncertainty and people start going to interviews for other jobs even before, you know, the changes happen. And those below them also do likewise. Then you see you have an ineffective, unstable, paralyzed state.
And the performance is affected dramatically.
And the performance will, of course, take a dip.
Okay.
So what I'm saying is to be head of state is a function of the state being stable and capable itself. And then, of course, closer to home, you also need a capable cabinet, you know, with, because these are the political heads who are going to head the various departments.
Yeah.
And so when you meet as cabinet, it must be a cabinet of people who read documents, because you can only have views if you've read the documents. You can only make, you know, suggestions and inputs in the discussions if you've read the documents. And so you must have a capable cabinet. Your cabinet colleagues must be people who are quite capable and can give you proper feedback as well.
But is the president not, due to that, the power of that title, okay, people respect it so much, is the president not the last one to know what's going on? I mean, people feed information to the president what they think he should know, or it's almost like, it's such a powerful position. No. I mean, are you really, how do you connect yourself with not, South Africa?
Yeah, but it's not like a command structure. It's not like the military. It's not like the police force, you know, where rank and communication upwards goes through the ranking system in that way.
Okay.
So, cabinet meets fortnightly, and the intervening week is for cabinet committees.
Yeah.
And that's where the memoranda and motivations are submitted, and the discussions and debates take place in preparation for cabinet meetings.
Yeah.
If you read all the documents, all the memoranda and the background documents, source documents that are submitted, even as president, you will have
a good feel.
A good feel of, you know, where things are going and so on. Because at the end, you are the one who's supposed to, using the collective brain, also guide and give support.
But how do you still connect to ordinary South Africans? Because if you're a president, you're my leader. I'm an ordinary person stuck in the traffic. I'm an ordinary person in Soweto, whatever, you know, a kid going to school. And you sometimes feel that powerful position literally makes a leader disconnect with their people. You look at the motorcades, the way that they drive all over the highway. You know, you better just get out of my way. You know, I'm the important guy. You're not. It's just a feeling of disconnection. Yeah. You know, they don't walk and kiss babies. They don't walk in the streets and knock on doors when they when you're president. You're just disconnected. I don't know.
Well, you know, protocol can create that kind of divide. It can create that kind of disconnect.
Yes.
Because if you go to a gathering, for instance, or even meetings of cabinet, the protocol people will say, no, Mr. President, people have not arrived as yet. If the meeting is set for 9 o'clock and it's 5 to 9, they'll want to keep you in your office until everyone is seated. But Nelson Mandela taught us that if the meeting is set for 9 o'clock, you must be seated at least 3 minutes to 9. So at 9 o'clock on the dot, you start the meeting. And I used to apologize sincerely to those who roll in after the set time. But I would make sure that I'm in the room to start the meeting at the set time.
Okay.
And anyone who comes later than that, we apologize to them, you know, sincerely. And it used to make them feel so bad that, they'll try and be on time the next time round.
But you're right, protocol can be a barrier, can't it, for a leader,
especially
in politics.
Protocol does that a great deal. And in my political seminars, I always emphasize the fact that, you know, if you go to funerals, even a funeral, just a funeral, don't accept when the people come to you and say, well, you know, please come to the front of the queue, because that will leave a wrong impression. It's important to be in the queue like everyone else.
Symbols. Everything is symbolic.
It's very, very important. Mm. Yeah, it's very, very important. But of course, you know, protocol's role is to ensure that you don't interact and you don't get feedback.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you are going to walk in only at the time when you are to address the people, and then you are taken out through a side door, then you will not get an opportunity to interact with them.
Did you, as president, and sometimes this may happen with leaders, have to make decisions that you, as an ordinary man, wouldn't have made?
Yes, many times.
Isn't that difficult? So even morally, maybe. So loyalty to ANC, loyalty to government, whatever it is, to that title, that position, president. I have to make decisions which, if I was an ordinary South African, I probably wouldn't have done this or wanted to do it. Scorpions people, everyone raises the scorpions issue for me. When you were president, you had to sign them away. What's that like? I mean, so you say you had to do that.
Yes, you have, however, be convinced that you are guided by facts and no sentiment.
Mm.
Yes, because you live with the decisions forever. And you got to be able to explain those decisions.
Mm.
Yes.
So one would think that as a person, you should never be placed in a predicament where you must make a moral decision, which you personally don't agree with, but because of the title and the position you hold, you have to now do that. But
well,
that's not realistic.
No, it's the demands of the office.
Yeah.
Yes, that the office will impose on you that responsibility, and the test is really to make sure that you are guided by facts and nothing but facts.
Okay. Sometimes just the facts, unemotional decisions.
That's right.
Did you want to say something, Louis?
Can I ask a bit of a sensitive question?
Yes,
President. Your presence is valuable here. Now, President, over the years, we've got to know quite a few of the ANC leaders. And we have found a consistent integrity amongst those we know. There is a feeling amongst many people, intelligent people too, that corruption is inherent in politics and also in ANC leadership. That's not been our experience. Would you comment on that? To what extent do ANC leadership feel opposed to corruption in any form?
Well, you know, when the ANC was proscribed in 1960. From that period up to 1990, the only reward that any ANC member could look forward to was liberation itself and or imprisonment or loss of limb or death or exile. Those were the only rewards that were available. And therefore, the kinds of people who ended up in the ranks of the ANC were people who were prepared to make that kind of sacrifice. But once the ANC was unbanned and became a legal organization, and worse still, as a governing party, positions in the ANC, membership of the ANC, always bring with them the possibility of lucrative rewards, in the form of contracts or whatever, and so on. And so, not only the new members, even the older members, get impacted upon by this new reality. And to overcome that requires checks and balances in the systems and institutions to protect, because human beings have their weaknesses. Not all human beings can at all times resist temptation. And so you need these checks and balances to eliminate any basis of people giving into temptation.
And that's a constant process.
It's a constant process.
Yeah.
But of course, once people try their hand at it and succeed, the temptation is strengthened as well. So we live with that in life. And the tendency would be for people to get even a bigger concentration of like-minded people, if you like. Once that happens, that concentration can only result in negative practices here.
President, our time is almost up, so I'm going to throw a few quick questions at you, quick answers back. Some people asked me to ask some of these questions, and some of them are mine. Should you have driven harder, you and Matthew Sporza particularly, at that last election with the ANC for the presidency and the deputy presidency?
No, in the ANC.
Do you feel happy with how you did it there?
I'm very happy. I'm at peace with myself because my principle and how I was mentored and taught by those who came before us was that to lead, you don't have to campaign, particularly if you are already in a leadership position. Because if you go back to the membership and say, elect me and canvass them, tomorrow when you are in office, you would not know whether they really have confidence in your capabilities or it is thanks to your election campaign and whatever sweetness you dispensed. And to lead, you need to know that the people you are leading have confidence in your capabilities.
They are authentic.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so I'm very happy.
BEE successful? Not? Give it a rating out of 10. 10 being perfect, 1 being useless.
Well, I would have loved BEE to really take into be extended to cover universities, the former Bush universities. Mm. There are universities that were meant for blacks. I would have been much happier if those were, regarded as BEE, because then they would take so many students through who would otherwise not be able to access higher education. So I've always had a problem with the way it is structured. Firstly, the first generation was debt-funded, and the second generation is still modeled that way. And so it's the financial institutions who are the real beneficiaries.
Yeah.
And I think it is in the greenfields where, there's got to be empowerment that's why I'm thinking more of universities, because then you can produce young entrepreneurs who will go out and all they need is just seed capital and repay it and start up new business, because the economy cannot benefit from continuous dilution because BEE as it stands now is dilution.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's based on implanting into existing businesses, whereas you need to grow the economy.
Yeah.
And so the empowerment must, be in the
broader.
Much, much broader.
Our time is up. There's questions about your involvement in e-tolls, the alliance between COSATU and ANC. Is that still relevant? Lots of questions, and we're not getting to them. Okay. Let's end on a positive note. Someone send a message here. Mr. President, to those who feel negative about the future of the country, what do you say to them?
Well, this is our country, as I said, all of us. And if, there's an appreciation of the national cause, which is to lift this country to a higher level, then all of us, wherever we are, must never ever lower the bar, must always give our best effort to because in cumulatively it will advance the country.
You have hope?
I have hope. I have hope.
And you're involved with your own foundation and other efforts to make a difference.
I'm still in the process of establishing it, yes.
Let me end with this thought. Catherine Constantinides, she tweeted this, work to become, not to acquire. And maybe we need to do that in the country more. Mm-hmm. And then I tweeted, there is a great shortage of peacemakers in our world today. Shake things up, but not at the cost of being a peacemaker. President, thank you.
Thank you for joining us here today.
We really appreciate it. I wish we had another hour, but for listeners out there, join us next week. We'll speak to Sam Paddock, co-founder of and CEO of Get Smarter. They are competing. They're taking on people like UNISA. Wonderful show it's going to be. Stay tuned for Candid Business with Alison Nyandu and Arnie Hicks. Thank you for joining us, and do join your Leadership Masterclass every single week. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
The Leadership Platform was brought to you by Sibanye Gold, a proudly South African mining company.
I am the future of South Africa. On my shoulders, I carry the hopes and dreams of generations to come. I'm eager to learn, but even more eager to use my knowledge for good. I know that it's not where I come from, but where I'm going to that really matters.
At Sibanye Gold, we believe our youth is worth its weight in gold, which is why we are so committed to developing, nurturing, and grooming our young people into future leaders. Sibanye Gold, we are one.